Hello and welcome to another weekly edition of Popcorn Optional, a movie podcast where we talk all things movies. And guess what came out today? The Oscar nominations. So we're going to be going through the Oscar nominations, talking about some surprises, some snubs, overall where films broke down, and kind of give you guys a sense of what all of this means and what this all means for a month and a half from now on March 4th when they finally have the actual 90th Academy Awards ceremony. I'm Cameron Salina, and with me tonight is Jake Brown.
What's up?
Trevor Allison is still out on paternity leave, but he will be back next week when we do our top 10 episode or top 10 movies of 2017, as well as some honorable mentions. But yeah, like I said previously, we're going to talk Oscar nominations tonight. And then our review of the week is we will be reviewing I, Tonya, Craig Gillespie's new film about Tonya Harding, starring Margot Robbie, Sebastian Stan, Allison Janney, and the unlikely Paul Walter Hauser, who blew everybody away as Sean Eckhart, terrifyingly. But let's go ahead and get into Oscar nominations. It's a interesting year in that nothing really too interesting happened. Everything kind of happened the way I think people thought it would. Shape of Water leads the crowd with 13 nominations. The record's 14 for nominations. La La Land, Titanic, and a 1950s film called All About Eve all have 14. Dunkirk has 8. 3. Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri has 7. Phantom Thread and Darkest Hour have 6, which is shocking that both of those films got 6. Considering that nobody thought either of them would get a lot. Lady Bird has 5. Get Out and Call Me By Your Name have 4. The Best Picture race is pretty straightforward. I think the only kind of snubs were people thought The Florida Project or Big Sick would get nominated. But everything that got nominated is pretty standard, right? Like, that's kind of what we all thought would get nominated.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few films that could have been nominated, but it's not exactly a snub that it didn't get nominated. Like, Disaster Artist, people were saying that Wonder Woman was going to get nominated for Best Picture, and I was like,
Warner Brothers put out a whole marketing campaign for Wonder Woman.
I know. It was weird. I mean, great movie, but it's not, I don't think it's the Best Picture.
No.
But yeah, I mean, the weird thing about the Academy is the 5 to 10 nominees for Best Picture. I'm like, just do 5 or just do 10. Because it doesn't really hurt anybody if you do 10. I think it makes it a more interesting race, personally.
If you do 10?
Yeah. Like, if you're going to open it up to 10 potential pictures, because I think they did it the year Dark Knight came out, right?
It was the year, like, after, because The Dark Knight didn't get nominated.
That's right. Yeah. People were ticked off.
Yeah, they went from 5 to 10, and then a couple years after they went to 10, they went to 5 to 10, and you have to receive 75% of the votes. And the reason why that happened, if I remember right, is because Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close got in as the 10th film, and it was not that well reviewed, but just because there wasn't that many great films that year, and so that was kind of just like thrown in there as like a, sure, why not?
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, I think people put too much focus on Best Picture for the Oscar nominations, or Oscar awards. I think the more interesting things are the performances, the performance awards, as well as the technical awards. Best Picture is just like such a like loose, vague term.
Yes.
And it's so subjective. Like, I mean, we just talked about Shape of Water last week, and I mean, you can listen to our review, but both Cam and I were not as high on it, or I don't know. I just, it's fine. But like, the fact that it has 13 nominations and is the front runner for Best Picture right now just kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. And that's the big reason why we want, and why we will be doing in a couple weeks, a 10 years later Oscar, where we will be re-rewarding the films from 2007 based on what they are perceived as today. Like, what films from 2007 have lived on? Not just what films won, but what films actually deserve that based on the legacy that they've left. Because oftentimes, that's very different. Like, what Jake just said, The Dark Knight's probably the most talked about film from 2008. I mean, there are other great films that came out in 2008. There Will Be Blood's fantastic. But is The Dark Knight really not one of the... Dark Knight's easily the most talked about film from 2008. And so that's kind of why we want to do that. Some of the exciting things is in directing Greta Gerwig and Jordan Peele, who Lady Bird is Greta Gerwig's first solo directing film. Jordan Peele's Get Out is his first time directing at all. Both got nominated for Best Director. Christopher Nolan receives his first nomination for Best Director, which is just shocking that it's taken him this long.
And honestly, Dunkirk is like not close to being his best film, in my opinion. And so that kind of felt more like there's not a ton of Best Director opportunity. I don't know. There were a lot of films this year that like were well done, but it didn't have like the director's staple on it. Like one thing I will say about Shape of Water is it is a Guillermo del Toro film. You watched 3 seconds of it and you immediately know who directed this film. Same with Dunkirk. And I think that was kind of a nod to Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, this is almost like when Scorsese got the nomination with The Departed. While it's not his best film, it's kind of a culmination of a career and, you know, something that he definitely deserves. And there's still a lot of people to this day that feel like The Departed was a career award when it won Best Picture for Scorsese and when he won Best Director because he hadn't won it up until that point.
Yeah, but I like The Departed.
I like The Departed too. It's a great film. Departed actually holds a special place in my heart. It's one of those films that like first kind of clicked in my brain as like, wow, movies are so much more than what I had previously thought. And that's kind of always where I land on it is like, I don't know if I have bias on it just because of that special place that it holds, but yeah, I like it. I think it's pretty, I mean, it gives you some career bests. I think that's one of Matt Damon's best acting performances of all time.
Oh yeah.
And maybe Mark Wahlberg's best performance of all time. Leonardo DiCaprio obviously has so many other performances that it's hard to choose from. But rounding out the director category is Paul Thomas Anderson for Phantom Thread and Guillermo del Toro for Shape of Water. Nothing surprising there. It's a pretty stacked category. My thing is always like, I don't always understand what the difference in the Academy voters' minds are between directing and picture. Like what would constitute somebody to nominate or to give somebody the best directing award, but not the best picture award?
It's kind of the best director award kind of goes to the art form of directing itself. Your creative vision, getting performances out of the actors and actresses. Back to Shape of Water. If Guillermo del Toro wins Best Director, I'm okay with that because of just like how uniquely him it is.
But wouldn't you say that the best directed film should be the best film?
Yes and no. There's actually a Vox video that actually kind of breaks this down of like why Best Director is such a weird category, because a good director just kind of gets out of the way of other creative people to do their jobs. You're essentially like steering the ship like one degree at a time and just trying to hold the course towards the end destination. That's the director's job, is to protect the creative vision. I think an example of like terrible direction is Amazing Spider-Man 2 with Mark Webb. Like that film was literally just like the studio just shoving every single thing they wanted to into that film. And the creative vision and direction was just 100% lost.
Right.
Directing is a really weird, vague art form. You're just trying to get the most talented people around you to like coach them through and like pass off your vision visually to the cinematographer, like character to the actor, and you just kind of have to like steward the story.
Right. That's definitely clear in all of these films. If you look at, especially Get Out, like Get Out, Jordan Peele is a very Jordan Peele movie if you've watched Key and Peele. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like he gets out of the way and lets that movie go. Like if I was to show you that movie, you wouldn't be like, oh, I wonder who directed that, because you're just so enthralled by that movie as a whole. Another, when we have a first in the 90-year history of the Academy Awards, Rachel Morrison, the cinematographer of Mudbound, is the first female nominated in the cinematography category, which is just shocking that it's taken this long, but congrats to her. And going from there is the fact that for the first time, there are some streaming services that have gotten nominations. Not the first time, but kind of the first year that's kind of been more prominent. So Netflix got three for Mudbound, and Amazon got one, which is original screenplay for The Big Sick. So congrats to both of those. Original screenplay this year is a stacked category. I mean, when you look at what is nominated in original screenplay, I'm fine giving the award to any of those. It's Big Sick, Get Out, Lady Bird, Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. That's just a stacked category.
Yeah, I mean, that could go to anybody, which is like, those are the most fun categories, in my opinion.
Yes.
Like, I think it was 2 years ago when, like, every technical award, it was like Mad Max. It wasn't even fun. Like, by the end of the Oscars, I was like, can we not hear that stupid drum song? Like,
Mad Max fully deserved every single one of those awards.
Absolutely. Like, but every single technical thing, it was like, oh, it's Mad Max, whatever. Like, I'm not even paying attention anymore.
Yeah. Logan was nominated as adapted screenplay, which, I'm trying to remember how many other nominations there have been for superhero films. Normally a superhero film is nominated in some tech categories, but in one of like the big categories, this is kind of one of the first nominations for a superhero film outside of Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker. So Logan fully deserves that. It's an amazing screenplay.
Yeah.
It's brutal. And exactly what I think everybody wanted finally out of a Logan movie. So happy that got made. Christopher Plummer becomes the oldest person ever nominated for supporting actor at 88, which is even more shocking when you figure that back in September of 2017, he wasn't even in the movie that he's nominated for. Kevin Spacey was playing the role, and he just came in and then shot the movie for like $1,000.
That whole story is just absolutely insane.
Do you think that's the biggest like movie story of 2017?
I think the whole Me Too movement is going to be what we remember 2017 for.
Unfortunately, Disney acquiring Fox.
Actually, yes. And like all of the $1 billion acquisitions that have happened.
Yes.
But I mean, that's gotta be number three or four on the list. That's going to be like some random trivia thing that like pops up in 15 years and everyone's like, holy crap, I can't believe they did. Like, it's insane. It's insane.
It's amazing. Congrats to Christopher Plummer. The best actor category, once again, seems to be a stacked category as well. You have Daniel Day-Lewis in his final performance. You have Gary Oldman in maybe his most deserving performance, and hopefully the one that gets it to him. Timothée Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name. And then rounding it out, you have Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, which is just, that makes me so happy to see that in there. But then, shockingly, you also have Denzel getting a nomination for Roman J. Israel Esquire.
Yeah. that was a film where it was like, I saw the trailer, and I was like, that looks interesting, just based on Denzel's performance. And then the reviews started coming out, and I was like, well, we're busy. The good thing and the bad thing about doing a movie podcast is I see more movies, but a lot of times I don't get to see the movie I want to, or it's like, I get to see one movie a week, so you miss all the other stuff. But like, based on the trailer, I was like, that looks like a good Denzel performance right there.
But how much of that is the fact that they use a Kendrick Lamar song in the trailer? Because oftentimes, Zack Snyder movies look great, but then you also look at the music and you're like, that's a great song.
Yeah, that's true, but I've never watched a Zack Snyder trailer and been like, man, Henry Cavill's performance in this, oof. This is going to be good.
Yeah, the shocking thing with the acting category is the fact that James Franco for The Disaster Artist was left out. Everybody thought that him playing Tommy Wiseau was a shoe-in for Best Actor, and he actually won at the Golden Globes for Best Actor in a Comedy or Musical. But I think the curious thing is there are two options as to why he was probably not, well, three, if you think it's neither of these two. But the two leading things are, the Academy always has a bias towards comedies. Comedies don't normally get the love that they deserve. Or two, the sexual assault allegations against James Franco came out 2 days before voting closed. And so I think the curiosity there is, how much did that factor into him not getting a nomination?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of the two. If it, I don't know when voting closes, if it had that much of an effect actually, but I mean, like, people talk, like, people know each other in this industry. It's a very small, tight-knit industry. And so I bet you that allegations were stirring, or there was rumors before they became public. So yeah, I think it's a combination of the two, because like you said, for some reason, the Academy Awards really don't reward comedy the way they should. But also, James Franco's a creep. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Going into the next category, and maybe the biggest shock of the whole thing was the fact that Boss Baby and Ferdinand are both nominated for Best Animated Film over the Lego Batman Movie.
Yeah, which is, I mean, this shocking. This wasn't a great year for animation. You know, I think that's pretty obvious, but
I think there's a heavy favorite to win that category in Coco.
Absolutely. I cannot believe that Lego Batman was not nominated. I think people probably just forgot about it because it came out like end of January of last year.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, it might have just gotten forgotten somehow, but I didn't see Boss Baby and I didn't see Ferdinand, but dear Lord, like, just based on the trailers, I can tell you 100% that Lego Batman was better.
Yeah. I mean, Lego Batman is... As I'm putting together my top 10 right now, it's an honorable mention.
Yeah, I kind of like, I mean, I kind of forgot that it happened this year, but it's fantastic. What's it at on Rotten Tomatoes right now?
It's like I think it's high 80s, low 90s. Let me check that really quick. One of my curious things when I like saw that was, I was wondering if people just saw the word Lego and got it mixed up with like the Lego Ninjago movie, which also came out this year.
Yeah, which was not good.
Yeah. And that one's 91%.
Yeah.
245 positive reviews.
That's pretty great.
So, and on the other side, I mean, you have the Lego Ninjago movie sitting at 54%. So, I think there's definitely an argument to be made for that. I'm not into conspiracy theories or anything. Lego Batman movie just deserves to be nominated.
Agreed.
The kind of finishing things out is the fact that Phantom Thread did a lot better than people thought. And part of the reason there was the fact that a lot of people, the thought was that they hadn't had time to go see Phantom Thread yet because it came out so late. But a lot of people who have been polled and asked about it, it was the last film they actually watched before they voted. So, interesting thing there. The Post and I, Tonya did way worse as far as nominations than people thought they would. The Post not getting too many nominees whatsoever. I, Tonya gets two nominees for actress in a leading role and actress in a supporting role. And The Post, I think, only got a couple.
I think it was like just Meryl Streep.
Got two.
And then like some
Best Picture.
Oh, okay. Best Picture.
Yeah, it's Best Picture and Meryl Streep, which Meryl Streep, of course, she's in a movie, she's going to get nominated. She'll get nominated next year for Mamma Mia.
Even it's ridiculous. Nobody sees it. It's like, it's a joke, but it's actually true.
Yes. It's the 100% like truest thing that like Meryl Streep's, like, she got nominated last year for Florence Foster Jenkins, which is fun. It's like, okay movie, but she does not deserve to be nominated for that.
Yeah.
And then the last piece of Oscar trivia for this round of the 2018 Oscars is the fact that the top three highest grossing films of the year, Star Wars The Last Jedi, Beauty and the Beast, and Wonder Woman, combined for a total of 5 nominations. So Star Wars ended up having 3 for original score from John Williams, sound editing, sound mixing, and Beauty and the Beast had 2 for costume design and production design. And after all of WB's efforts, Wonder Woman ends up with a big fat 0. Not even a VFX award.
Yeah. I don't really know what to say about that stuff. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, the studio is just happy with how it performed, and yeah. I mean, people are going to go see the sequels. So
yeah, good let's for face them. It. Wonder Woman is a success by every definition that it should be a success yeah. by.
And honestly, it's like, as much as we like Wonder Woman, is it a artistic masterpiece? Is it pushing the boundaries of cinema? It like, not really. And so,
no,
you know, those movies don't get the awards for a reason. Like, it was a great, very entertaining film. But I mean, it's not doing a ton of social commentary or pushing boundaries or anything. It's a superhero movie. It's just a really right. good superhero movie.
Yeah. And when I started thinking about yesterday, when I was thinking, you know, could Wonder Woman pull out some nominations? And I started thinking about, like, okay, is it one of the best films of the year? And I just kept thinking about the third act and how much things just kind of fall apart with the villain and everything. And I was like, I don't even think it's the best superhero movie that's come out this year, let alone deserves to be nominated for one of the best films. I think it's a culture, it made a huge cultural impact, but not always cultural impacts don't always deserve to be nominated for best film. And that's kind of where I think that one landed. I think Wonder Woman years from now will be remembered as a touchstone of 2017, but it doesn't necessarily deserve to be fit within that category.
Right.
If there ever was going to be a Star Wars film nominated for Best Picture, I think this was our best chance, but it just wasn't in the cards. And that's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
Do you think the last thing I'll touch on is, do you think Roger Deakins wins Best Cinematography over Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Mudbound, and Shape of Water?
Well, I've only seen two. No, I've seen Dunkirk, Shape of Water, Blade Runner. I haven't seen Mudbound. I haven't seen Darkest Hour. Yeah. I think that Blade Runner, out of the things I've seen, has the best cinematography out of them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just, it's Roger Deakins. He's lost, I think, 15 times.
Is it that many?
I think it's at least 13. It might be 15. And, you know,
he's lost 13 so far. Blade Runner is his 14th nomination.
Okay. This is, Blade Runner was a technical masterpiece. Visually, it was incredible. And also the way that the visual effects blended with the real life footage, which Roger Deakins acts as a VFX lighting and cinematography supervisor on every film that he DPs. So I don't understand why he wouldn't win it, but at the same time, I don't know, man. The Academy does weird stuff.
Yeah. They did come out with information that what happened last year with Moonlight, I don't know why I couldn't say that. I was like, I literally couldn't get the word light out of my mouth. Moonlight and La La Land for Best Picture won't be happening again. They've put in fail safes and a couple of different things to make sure that doesn't happen. And in my mind, I'm going, look, does the Academy not understand that was one of the greatest things to happen to them?
Oh, yeah.
The buzz they got off of that was huge.
Yeah. Like, it's bad press, but all press is good press, right?
And in that, it's not necessarily bad. Like, nobody's going to remember that and be like, oh my gosh, we shouldn't attend the Academy Awards because they messed up the balloting. Like, nobody's going to ever think that. It's good press in that it's like some no-name person who, let's face it, made a very easy mistake, probably got fired, and it brought a lot of attention to Best Picture.
Yep.
So the reason why I always like talking about Oscars and awards, and I know I've knocked on them before, is it's just a good way to bring attention to films, performances, technical pieces of films that not many people would know. And my frustration with the Academy Awards normally comes in the form of, I don't think they award the films that deserve to be nominated or the films that deserve to be awarded. But I think this year there's a lot of potential for them to get a lot of categories right. I don't know how the Best Picture race is going to turn out. And when you look back on so many of the best picture winners, it's not the film from that year that won doesn't always serve as a representation. And I look at in 2011, I think it was, when The King's Speech won, but Social Network also came out that year. And I'm curious what the film of this year will be that will win, because I would love to see Get Out win it. I think Get Out is an amazing film. I think Three Billboards is an amazing film as well. Do I think either of them have a realistic chance? Maybe, but the front runner definitely seems at this point to be Shape of Water. I think, yeah, if it's going to be anything, it's going to be Shape of Water. So if I was a betting man, that's where I would place my bets, but I'm not a betting man. So yeah, that's all we have for our talk of the Oscar nominations. The Oscars will be out on March 4th. We'll do a little bit of analysis once that comes out on another episode, probably around that time. And then in a couple of weeks, we will do our 10 years later Oscars, where we re-award the Academy Awards from 2007, 10 years later, based on what we think has stood the test of time and actually deserves to get the awards from that year. So look forward to that. But let's go ahead and get into our review of I, Tonya. Jake, what were your general thoughts about I, Tonya?
Yeah, man. These kind of movies, these are my movies, man. These are the kind of movies that I want to make someday. I loved this movie. I was thoroughly entertained the entire time. I was never bored. Everybody involved gives incredible performances. I think Margot Robbie and Allison Janney are both very deserving of the nominations and the recognition they're getting for this. I know that there's some controversy about the popularity of this film that we'll talk about later, that we're like supposed to embrace and forgive Tonya Harding. I don't think this movie is trying to apologize for what she does at all. I think, in fact, my favorite thing about this movie is just the questions it makes the viewer ask themselves of what is truth, what is the role of the media, where does fault really lie. I loved it. I really, really enjoyed this movie a lot and would recommend pretty much anybody see this movie.
It's I was definitely one of those people that Jake was talking about that was like, why are we supposed to be embracing Tonya Harding? And I think part of that stems, I hadn't even thought that was that was partly what this movie was going for until Allison Janney, during her Golden Globes acceptance speech for Best Actress, Best Supporting Actress, thanked Tonya Harding and how much of an inspiration she was. And I was like, Tonya Harding's not the victim in this situation. She was the person who capped somebody's knees. Like, that's not the person that we should be forgiving. But I think, and that was part, like, I think I went into this movie with a chip on my shoulder. And the movie directly addresses that, and not like directly addresses it as like there's a line about that. There's a scene where Margot Robbie as Tonya Harding directly looks at the audience and is like, addresses them as like, you all thought this about me. You all feel this way. You all think this way. This is what you guys think. And that's like, I think there's some power in the way that this movie doesn't try to make you feel as if Tonya Harding was in the right in what she did, because she's not. But I think what this movie is just trying to do is contextualize and give the audience a perspective of like, here's the events shaping up to this. I was shocked at how much of this movie was the events leading up to the incident with Nancy Kerrigan. Because I was under the impression that like, we'd probably get a little bit of like a background, and then the majority of the movie, probably like the end of the first act, would be the incident happening, and then we would go from there. And the rest of the movie would be the incident, the after effects, when really the incident doesn't happen until in the third act, partially like, I mean, there's probably like 30 minutes left in the movie when it happens.
It's actually like the middle of the movie. The exact.
Oh, it is?
It's an hour and like 5 minutes in, and this is a 2-hour film. So it's like right in the middle.
Oh, okay. Well, the second half felt a lot shorter than the first half.
The second, like once it happens, the aftermath stuff is like, it buckle in, man. It's
yeah.
It who would have thought figure skating would be such a wild ride?
Yeah, and ultimately, and we'll get into like our thoughts on the situation as well as how that relates to the movie in a little bit, but I think that this movie handles things with a very responsible way. Like, it's not trying to shy away from what happened or who was responsible or who played a hand in what, but it's going, here are the facts, but here's also like who this person is. And that's a very interesting field to get in, because most times in incidents like this, the contextualization of who the non-victim and not necessarily attacker or instigator or whoever is, that's not something that plays into it. And that's a very, I think that that's something that this movie brings up, is like, who is this person? Like, you guys think that you know her and there's a perception that you have of her from the press, but that's not always 100% true. And what you don't always see factors into a lot of who this person ends up being and how this person got to where they were. And I'm not saying that the means justify the end, but I mean, you definitely get to understand who Tonya Harding is a lot more from this movie, which I think is a very powerful thing. What did you know of this incident going into it, and how did that contextualize your thoughts?
Yeah. So, the only negative thing I can really say about this movie is that, I'm pretty knowledgeable on the story, because there's a 30 for 30 about it called The Price of Gold, which interviews Tonya Harding and covers a lot of this same narrative. So I think that's really the only complaint I have about the movie, is that I think with a biopic, if you go in knowing a lot of the story and the characters and the nuances and the twists, it's not as impactful, because it's a true story. And if you know the true story, it's, I don't know, it's like reading the book before a movie. It's like, you know how it's going to end.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think that really took away too much from my viewing experience, because I still loved it.
Right. And that's always, I think, what you can tell as far, like, what the big thing as far as true stories is. And I remember this feeling when I went to go see the movie Argo, was I knew the events. I had read a lot about them, and the movie still had me on the edge of my seat as I was watching it. Like, I knew, spoiler, if you don't know what happens in the 1970 hostile situation with Iran and the secret mission behind that, this is going to spoil it for you. But I knew that the characters got out of there. It was Iran, right? I don't want to like misquote this and be like blaming country.
It was, I think, a U.S. embassy in Iran hostage situation / like the Canadian embassy was hiding our people or something.
Yes. Hid them for Iran. Okay, good. Tehran. And they were hiding in the Canadian embassy, like Jake said. And I knew that the people got out, but that doesn't take away from the impact of the story or from the tension that was created during the story. And I think this movie, you know how things are going to end. You know where Tonya ends up. You know where Nancy ends up. You know who finishes where, what happens where, who got put in jail, who didn't get put in jail. But that doesn't take away from the movie, because the movie is so much more than that. And it's really about, like, everybody has in their head a perception of who Tonya Harding is, who Jeff Galluli is, who Sean Eckhart is, who these people are that were behind this incident. And this movie is not meant to try and sway you one way or the other. It kind of presents things in a very, it's not 100% unbiased, but I feel like it's pretty fair. Like, it presents the bad and the good of Tonya Harding. Like, yeah, she was pretty rough and abrasive and not always the nicest of people towards her competitors or towards people. Did she have a hand in things? Yeah, slightly. Was it as big as most people think? Probably not, but does she deserve to have everything that happened to her as horrible has it, I don't like, and yeah, we'll get into that in just a little bit, but it, yeah, the movie's power is in how it frames things and gives you this perspective.
Yeah.
Anything else before we get to our spoilers?
I think you kind of have to with this movie.
Okay. Let's go ahead and get to spoilers. If you haven't seen I, Tonya yet, or if you know about the 1994 incident with Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding and want to keep listening anyways, go right ahead. I think if you know things about the incident, it's not going to take away, and you keep listening to our spoilers, it's not going to take away from the movie, because like Jake already said, he knew quite a bit and it, you know, was still a pretty great movie for him. So let's go ahead and get into spoilers right now for I, Tonya. The first thing that kind of comes out to me is the physical abuse scenes in this movie, which are just brutal to watch. Like, they don't shy away from that whatsoever.
Yeah.
They kind of go for it, and that was honestly hard to watch. It just like created this sympathy for this character of like, man, I wish that I could, like, it was that character of like, I wish I could just help her, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously it's not fun to watch, but like, I'm glad that they didn't, pull any punches. Pardon the pun, with the way they showed it. Like, it was raw. It was scary. It sucks, but it like explains so much of why she was the person she was. And like, you can't make this movie without those scenes.
Right. I think that's ultimately where framing of the character comes in, is, you know, you kind of have an idea of what Tonya's going through. And I think a lot of people knew that she was being abused by her husband, but to the extent that she had been physically, mentally, emotionally abused by her mom, that was the part that shocked me more than anything. Cause that's like, I always bring this up, but it plays into a lot of how I view things now. But as a dad, I just can't even imagine doing some of those things to your kid, or like talking to them that way, trying to quote unquote motivate them in that way. It's just so counterculture to what you should be doing as a parent.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because in the 30 for 30, The Price of Gold, they talk about her abusive life and, just all the stuff she went through. But honestly, they kind of portray her in a way of where it's just like, woe is me, it's not my fault, like it's just all these excuses for her life. But in this film, Tonya is still kind of that character of like, that's not my fault, but you see what has happened in her life to actually put her in a place where a lot of this stuff is not her fault. Seeing the actual abuse happen, it takes away that disconnect of, well, these are her choices, this is her fault. It's like, well, some of it, yeah, but like a lot of it, no.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the most interesting thing, and this is where I'm always curious, and I couldn't really find anything on this, but the most interesting thing is the relationship between Sean Eckhart, who was her husband, Jeff Galluli's good friend, as well as Jeff Galluli, their relationship and their kind of schemings behind the scenes, which was something I didn't really know. And there's a part in the movie that, if it's true, I don't know if it is or not, I couldn't find anything, but the scene where he's sitting there, Sean Eckhart, and he's like, yeah, I was the one that sent the death threats to Tonya so that it would create a boom in my bodyguarding business. That was the part that I was just like, what the hell? Like, that, oh my goodness.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true, but just that character, like, one, first off, the guy who plays him does an incredible job.
Yes. Credit goes to Paul Walter Hauser.
Yeah, who so good.
I think this is his only IMDb credit. It's just fantastic a counterterrorism expert.
Oh my gosh, so good. And like the way that they were writing him and the way he was playing it, I was like, this is so over the top. There's no like really who would think, but then they cut to the interviews and the credits of the real life people. And he actually says that he's a counterterrorist expert that has operatives working for him all over the world. I was like, oh my gosh, you can't make this stuff up. This guy's actually like this.
Yes. It's mind blowing.
Their relationship was hilarious. And also Sebastian Stan didn't recognize him at all in this role until his name came up in the credits, and man, he was good.
For those of you who don't know, Sebastian Stan plays Bucky, aka the Winter Soldier, in the Captain America and Marvel films, and he plays Jeff Galluli, Tanya Harding's husband, and he's just, I mean, he's mind-blowingly good. His accent, his mannerisms, like, I went back and watched, like, interviews with Jeff Galluli, and he is fantastic. I was kind of shocked today after having seen this movie and then looking at the nominations that he hasn't gotten more love for this role, because he kills it.
And Sebastian Stan is one of those actors who, like, he has a very signature look. Like every other thing he's been in, I'm like, oh yeah, that's the Winter Soldier. But like in this movie, did not recognize him at all, and he did a fantastic job. Also, like the costume design and hair and makeup, everything technically in this movie is also top notch.
Yeah, this film, it does so many things right that when you ultimately get down to the story, I completely, like halfway through the movie when it came out, I was just so enthralled by the cinematography and the story and the characters, the performances, that when you get to that part, all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, that's why we're here. We're all here for this one big moment. And man, that moment is, it's shocking what happened. Like I was curious of, was it really that accidental that guy, Shane Stant, actually got behind all that security and everything that easily? And it's, supposedly that's exactly how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, these guys are idiots. Like,
yes,
the dumbest people.
Yes. And it's, that was, so Jake, you commented on they're playing up the stupidity. But the stupidity of these people, when you actually look into things, this is how stupid they actually were.
Yeah, like they actually put everything on their personal credit cards. Like,
yes,
if you watch the 30 for 30, it goes more in depth than like the planning behind the hit and like how they found them. And it's like literally any person with any common sense or has ever watched any form of crime show or whatever would know how to do it better than these guys did.
What do you think of Allison Janney? Because she's the one that's been getting all of the talk out of this movie for how great she was.
Dude, I don't care what you guys say. Allison Janney is a minch in my heart.
Were you the one that nominated her?
Yeah, and you guys shut her down. But she's amazing in this role. Like her, I loved all the interview stuff and like the breaking of the fourth wall, but the interview stuff especially. That you can't do this movie without that. Like that was the directing glue. That's a best director moment of knowing how to do it properly. And all of her interactions with the bird and her and Margot Robbie's interaction. Just amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. I've loved Allison Janney. She's always been someone special. I know it doesn't seem that way because I didn't vote her in as an honorable mensch. That's a whole different conversation. But she's fantastic in this movie, and she's able to flip things on a switch. And the scene that ultimately sold it for me was the scene where she goes over to Tanya's apartment after everything has happened and is acting all nice to her. And I was completely like, oh my gosh, that's so nice of her. Like, this is the moment we've been waiting for her mom to finally like give her some love and care. And then it's revealed that her mom's trying to record her admitting that she has something to do with it so she can sell it and make some money. And that was the moment that I was like, goodness, the way that she handled that flip and played that deception. And I mean, Allison Janney deserves the Academy Award for this performance. And, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say it as well, that I think I would be very happy if Margot Robbie got the Best Actress Award for this, because disappears in this role. She fully embodies Tonya Harding.
Yeah. I've been a Margot Robbie fan for a long time. I thought she was a very underused actress and was often just like put in as a pretty face, because she does have the stereotypical like pretty blonde Hollywood look. But man, in this movie, she gives some really raw performances. And does an incredible job. Like, and also a lot of the skating is actually her. Like, not the triple axels or anything like that, but like all of the more minor stuff is all her.
Yeah, because that's something I was curious about, because there are a couple of shots that you can definitely tell are face mapped onto a stunt double.
Yeah.
But how much, like, did you find something online that talked about, like, what percent or how much of it she actually did?
I didn't see a percentage. I saw some interviews of her talking about just like how much training she went through to be ready for the film, and like how much she was doing, like 3 or 4 hours of skating a day, and actually was like training with Tonya Harding as her coach for part of the time. And then, I mean, also it's just like, I don't want to sound annoying, but I can tell. Like, I can see VFX and face mapping pretty easily. And so I was just kind of able to be like, oh yeah, that's definitely her, or that's not her. Or, and most of the time, unless it was some crazy stuff, it was her.
Yeah. Wow. That's impressive. And that's the type of dedication that like you expect from an actor. And there's a lot of times where actors don't give that kind of dedication, but the fact that she did and she went for it and trained, and that's the type of thing that makes films like this impressive and kind of stand the test of time, is when that authenticity is there. So well done to her. That's incredible. And she, the scene that ultimately like sold me on her as far as acting was the scene at the end where she's putting on her makeup before her Olympic performance. And she's like, any scene where you just kind of stay on an actor as they're doing something, and there's no really motion. It's just kind of them on camera just for like a couple minutes. And the rawness of that scene, it's like everything that you need to know about the movie can be summed up in the emotions in that single scene.
Yeah. That scene alone, I was like, Margot Robbie could take the Oscar. Like, I'm totally fine with it.
I think so. A lot of times in movies, there's like a litmus test moment always for movies like this, as far as like, if you like this scene, you'll like this movie. And I think this movie kind of hinges on how you end up, where you lie on the whole Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing. And I think if you ultimately feel bad for her in that moment and you go with those emotions, you're probably going to like this movie. If you watch that and you're like, what does she have to cry about? She's not the one who got her kneecapped. Then you're probably not going to like this movie and be somebody that this movie ultimately doesn't resonate with. But that scene for me, man, that was a fantastic scene.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Were you able to watch The Price of Gold before you, or like after you saw this, or before?
No. But I love ESPN 30 for 30s. And so like if they're on Netflix, or if I have a couple hours to kill or whatever, and I want something on in the background while I'm working, like that's a go-to for me. So I've seen it at least twice, I think, in the last couple years. So I was pretty fresh with the story.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not on Netflix anymore. I tried to watch it, but I mean, you can pay $2 to watch it on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. So I might do that just because I'm curious from a historical standpoint, I have a feeling that ESPN is pretty historically accurate with their stuff, but
there was nothing watching it that I was like, oh, that didn't happen, or like they changed that around or whatever. Like, I mean, everything in this film, I was remembering stuff from The Price of Gold.
Yeah, the big scene that I was curious about was the scene we talked about where Sean Eckhart says that he was the one that sent the.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Because
that's something that's like,
that's crazy.
I almost feel like, well, I think he's passed away. That's something that's almost borderline like slanderous, that if it's not true, he could file like a lawsuit or something, because that's a pretty big allegation. So I'm like, that has to be somewhat accurate, whether, because I'm pretty sure that the writing of this movie was from like interviews, like private interviews with Tonya Harding and Jeff Galluli.
Yeah.
And so there has to be something like that that came out that was pretty true,
I guess. Because when he said that, I was like, he's not smart enough to do that.
No. But gosh, man, the idiotic nature of that character just blows my mind. Or yeah, that person.
The performance is so good.
Yeah.
Like, I keep forgetting his name, but man, he does such a good job.
And the acting in this movie is just fantastic. I mean, you have Bobby Cannavale, who's in like maybe a minute total of screen time, just as a hard copy producer. That's just like, every time he comes on screen, is the most entertaining person.
Mm-hmm.
I have a soft place for Bobby Cannavale, so that's one thing. But the acting overall in this movie is just mind-blowingly good.
Yeah, it's,
and
everyone involved is bringing their A game for sure.
Yeah, which is interesting when you look at who the director is, because he's had some interesting films. Craig Gillespie, the director, directed The Finest Hours last year with Casey Affleck and Chris Pine. He's also directed Million Dollar Arm with John Hamm, Fright Night with Anton Yelchin, and what's that guy's name? The Irishman. Colin Farrell. Lars and the Real Girl, which is fantastic. And then he directed Mr. Woodcock with Sean William Scott and Billy Bob Thornton. So, I mean, he's kind of had like an interesting arc to his career, but there's definitely like, I mean, this is definitely his best film to date.
Yeah. I mean, this movie's great. I loved it. I'm trying to think if I have anything else to say or if we should just get to grades.
So the last thing is, I think one of the things I want to talk about was what was the purpose and the goal of this movie. And I think we've talked about that in terms of this movie's not trying to make you think that Tonya Harding is a good person, but it's just trying to contextualize the events and be like, look, if you are in this situation with all of this, where would your mind be?
So one thing I love about this movie is, you know, with biopics, there's always the question of like, how historically accurate is it? And, you know, biopics in general are just like, they're mostly true. Like, it's true on the macro level, but strongly fictionalized for dramatic effect. But this movie, like, my favorite thing about it is the core issue with this real life event is that nobody really knows what's happened. Like, it's entirely he said what she said. And that's why I think the interview scenes and like breaking the fourth wall are so important, and not just stylistic, but it's also like one of the key questions of the film is like, what is truth? Because everyone's perspective is different. And so they will have their truth, and it might be different than somebody else's truth. So there is no truth. And, it doesn't take away any of the blame from Tonya. In fact, it like quite vividly shows the mistakes she makes. And you know, we're supposed to connect with her. And this entire movie is basically just a giant mirror that's held up to the American people and our media system for devouring her and spitting her out, like, and leaving her to be forgotten, just like so many other people that have had their 15 minutes of fame. But we don't take the time to like understand the person in the situation, how they got there, and like what drove them to make the decisions that they made. And so this doesn't like change my opinion on her a ton, but I just think it does a really, really good job of walking that tightrope of leaning into bias or leaning into crazy fictionalized, dramatized story. I think it just really presents what happened in a really fun and entertaining way that makes you think. And if you told me that this movie was going to make me think as much as I did about truth and media and justice and like sport itself and blame and relationships and the impact that we have psychologically on each other, I would have told you there's no way, it's just a biopic. But I think this is one of the most like influential movies of the year. And I would be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if it was on my top 10 or even top 5 of this year.
Wow. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think this changes my mind, but it definitely recontextualizes things. And I think part of it is just wanting you to connect with that character and be like, she's just another person who grew up, who wasn't loved, and simply was just like, what can I do to possibly be loved by my mom, by my husband, by judges, by people? And I mean, she wanted so desperately to be loved that she was willing to go to any extent because she wasn't going to get it in a fair way. And that's heartbreaking. And it's something that you have to definitely think about when you think about the person of Tonya Harding, is what are you willing to do to simply just be loved? And I think that that's such a thing that we take for granted, that we have people, you know, who love us and care for us. But if you had nobody who felt that way about you, what would you be willing to do to get that? And
yeah,
that's something that resonated with me. It's something that kind of clicked when I thought about the person of Tonya Harding. I keep wanting to say character, but I then remember it's like, no, this is a real person's life. This is a real thing that happened. And, you know, it breaks my heart that she had to go through her childhood that she did. Now, I don't, you know, think that she made the right decisions when it came to this situation, but at the same time, I think that people deserve a second chance. And, you know, I think it's heartbreaking from a lot of different angles, for Nancy Kerrigan, what happened to her, for Tonya Harding, and just, you know, it's just a sad situation on a lot of levels. But what, let's go ahead and get into our ratings. Jake, what do you give this film?
Yeah, I mean, I've been raving about it. I mean, like I said, I think my viewing experience was a little hindered by the price of gold 30 for 30, which in itself is fantastic and I would highly recommend. And that's really the only negative thing I have to say about this film, is that I think I went in with a little too much knowledge. But everybody involved is just fantastic. I wish this was getting more awards recognition. And I hope Margot Robbie and Allison Janney win. Like, if they win, I would be very happy with both of those, or either one. Technically, this film is really top notch. I loved it. So yeah, I'm gonna give it a 97%. You know, that could be an A+. It could be an A. I don't really know which one I want to pick. But this is one of the best of the year for me by far.
Yeah. It's I'm with you. It's up there. I've started putting together my top 10 in anticipation of next week's episode. It'll definitely be an honorable mention. I don't know, when I look at the films that are my top 10, it's a stacked category because this was just such a great year for movies. I think in a lot of years this makes it in there. But man, it's just a great year for movies, and this is just another great film to add to the already great list. I think the one thing standing in Margot Robbie's way of a Best Actor nom is Frances McDormand in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And yeah, she's been cleaning up. And the exciting thing is that I'm perfectly happy with either of those two people getting it. Either of those people get it, I'm good. They both deserve it. They both did fantastic jobs. But yeah, I think this is a great movie that handles a very fragile situation in a very intelligent and complicated way. And so I give this movie an A. I think it's a great film. very well done to the cast. The cast is ultimately what makes this movie as good as it is. And good job for Craig Gillespie and his direction of the film. But that's all we have for our review of I, Tonya. Let's go ahead and get to our content of the week. Jake, what is your content of the week?
Yeah, so what I'm recommending this week, I've only watched one episode of it, and it's been out for a while, but so far I'm very much enjoying Ozarks with Jason Bateman. The first episode is fantastic. There were a lot of twists and turns that I didn't see coming, and it's just, it's cool to see Jason Bateman play this kind of like dramatic, serious role, which he doesn't usually do. And he actually directs the pilot episode. He might direct more episodes later, I'm not sure. But it's just, it's really, really well done, really high quality, a lot of fun. It's intense, but it's on Netflix, so watch it. Yeah.
There we go. I'm going to recommend a book I listen to on audiobook on Audible. Audible, if you want to sponsor us, we would love to be sponsored by you. It's called Artemis, and it is from the guy who wrote The Martian. His name's Andy Weir, and it takes place on the moon. It's narrated by Rosario Dawson. And if The Martian is a science book in outer space, this is a hacking and technology book in the moon. And it takes place like on a civilization on the moon set like 50 years in the future. I think it's in like the 2090s. And there's like a colony on the moon of like 2,000 people in a city called Artemis. And it's very well done. Rosario, if you listen to it, Rosario Dawson does a great job. I will say there's quite a bit of language if you're sensitive to that. But yeah, it's a very entertaining book that I think would make a fantastic movie. And I would definitely watch it. And I think if Rosario Dawson played the main character, that would be even better. So that's all we have for this week. If you've enjoyed listening to us, share us with a friend, give us a 5-star review on iTunes, and leave us a review letting us know what you thought. We're going to be back next week with our top 10 films of 2017, where we will be joined by Trevor. But until next time, you can find us on Twitter at Popcorn Optional, on Facebook at Popcorn Optional. If you want to listen to more of our episodes, you can find us on iTunes or on our website at popcornoptional.com. My name is Cameron Slinger. You can find me online at 321 Cami Time. Jake, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Instagram at jakebrown.tv, and that's actually also my website URL, so I'll see you there.
Trevor's online at Turbo Trevor, so find him there. As always, we've loved getting to talk to you guys about movies, and so until next week, pop, pop!